security tech available to the governor might be cutting edge on this world. I've been to planets where even middle-class merchants command better resources. The Adeptus Mechanicus has never had a great interest in placating the servants of the Imperium on Shokan, he said. Our world is a convenience to them, no more. Suffice it to say that the members of their brotherhood that they send to work planetside are somewhat short of their best and brightest.
You cannot be serious, said Ashiel.
Of course I'm serious, said Hanrik, and Ashiel had little reason to doubt him. I know that it's painful to consider, but Governor Matkinson's... He paused. Father's death may very well have been precisely what Idanel thinks. An accident.
It seems so awfully convenient, does it not? Ashiel said.
She could feel the suspension of the carriage attempting to adjust to account for the inclination. The road was rising, which meant they had left the centre of Custovium and were nearing the highlands of the capital, the oldest districts where the wealthiest homes were located. Hanrik hesitated and nodded. It does, I'll concede. He stared out of the window, and Ashiel couldn't tell if he was staring at the scenery or lost in thought again. And you suspect the Venaissans?
They have the most to gain, she said. Whether or not they were responsible, they now circle our house like carrion birds.
Was that what your messenger was about? She nodded absently.
A go-between for Acelia Venaissan.
Any idea what she wanted? Hanrik asked.
Ashiel frowned.
She had to remind herself that Hanrik hadn't spent the last several decades knee-deep in the politics of Shokan.
She had floated the notion of marriage between myself and Tanzeg Venaissan to father on a number of occasions, said Ashiel. No doubt she believes that my position, being somewhat precarious, makes marriage to her son a more attractive prospect.
Does it?
Of course not, said Ashiel. She shuddered. I can scarcely think of anyone I'd rather be married to less.
Hanrik smiled for the first time since he'd been home. Ashiel laughed.
What is it?
She asked. Your revulsion, he said. I think that's the most honest reaction I've seen from you since before I left. I don't remember Tanzig.
Ashiel shook her head. Acelia's oldest child, she said. Officially, he governs the family's ancestral holdings in waste management.
On Shokan, a planet where agriculture was the primary industry, waste management and reclamation was a necessary and lucrative profession.
In reality, he governs the majority of the family's criminal enterprises. Illegal usury, smuggling, gambling, unlicensed prostitution. Trace any of them back far enough, and more often than not, the trail ends with someone in Tanzeg Venaissan's employ.
Underworld scum, said Hanrik, a byproduct of any world with a civic government.
If he were just an organising force on the criminal element, she said, I might be able to come to an arrangement, but he's a wanton sadist. He considers himself a master at breaking household servants, training them to difficult tasks with savage punishments. Supposedly, he covers his unruly lieutenants in skin irritants and locks them in footlockers with shards of broken glass. The criminal gangs call it the boo-boo box.
And the enforcers are not sufficient to the task? Hanrik asked.
They might be if they were committed to it, Ashiel said. But the wardens are the province of the Gravenet.
In theory, the mustering and control of the wardens, the enforcers of Shokan, being given to the Gravenet established a check on the authority of the regent and the coadjutor. In truth, each officer among the wardens was wholly the creature of whichever noble had sponsored their rise through the ranks, and the reins of these nobles were in turn held by the ruling families. So there are as many among the wardens that owe their fealty to you as there are who answer to the Venaissans? No matter what she might think of Hanrik, he was no fool. Then again, she supposed the politics of Shokan were likely not too difficult to pass out, the broad strokes, at least. Have you brought the issue before, Judge Idanel? He asked. Ashel paused to consider her words carefully.
Not I, she said.
But Father did, Henrik asked.
He really was quite quick on the uptake.
Yes, she said, after giving some consideration to her wording.
Judge Idenal's professional judgment was that the Venaissons' enterprises were limited enough in scope to constitute a local matter, rather than a violation of the Lex Imperialis.
Henrik nodded, his gaze distant.
Not atypical, he said,
especially among sole arbitrators in charge of entire worlds or installations. Do you see his position as laxity?
Ashiel smiled at Henrik's dogged refusal to speak ill of the senior arbitrator directly.
Not at all, she said. I'd like to see it not as laxity, but efficiency. Thus far, Father and I have kept the corruption of the Venetians from affecting Shokan's tithe output. Since that is the only aspect of the planetary management which might affect the broader Imperium, it stands to reason that Judge Idenel's attention is indeed better spent on the Calistonian. Given the continuous interaction between the various factions on board the facility, there is doubtless much to hold his attention there.
She hesitated to speak ill of one of her brother's peers, but she also didn't want to begin the renewal of their relationship by lying to him.
I suspect Judge Idenel is a man who values order above all else. So long as I continue to provide that, he will accommodate me to an extent. But I don't see him putting himself out on my account, nor do I think he would hesitate to remove the governor under a charge of incompetence before the throne if the political situation ever deteriorated that far.
The carriage ground to a halt. Which leaves you in a difficult position, I assume.
Henrik paused at the carriage door.
You perform your duties so well that you cannot get the aid you need.
Ashiel smiled at his hesitation. Conventional etiquette demanded he exit and offer her his hand. But social etiquette also dictated he wait to allow the governor to exit first. She laughed and slipped through the door.
For what it's worth, Henrik said as he stepped to the ground, it's an excellent capital.
The sun had sunk below the rain clouds, although not yet below the horizon, allowing a brief moment of unimpeded light before the start of the chill Shokan night. Throughout the city, the brass cornices and columns of the highest buildings reflected the dwindling light like polished mirrors, casting their red-gold glow onto the streets below. In the final moments of sunset, Shokan was nearly as bright as midday.
It is at that, Ashel said.
Chapter 3 Ashel was exhausted. Not just tired. She'd gone to bed tired before, during the mandatory 4 years she had done with the Shokan High Service at her father's insistence. She'd come to know tiredness intimately. No, this was utter exhaustion. She sat in the huge wingback chair in her father's bedchamber, too weary even to admonish herself that it was her bedchamber now. Unable to summon the energy to even move to the bed. She'd had her father's bed, the ancient canopied monstrosity he'd shared with her mother, hauled into storage, and her own, slightly less ostentatious furniture moved from the Heir Secundus suite lower in the palace. Some of it would have to be either returned or replaced eventually, but she had to draw a line somewhere. Her duties and daily tasks now revolved around stepping into her father's skin in so many ways, but the assumption of his private trappings was something she couldn't bring herself to do. The belongings in the bedchamber had been witness to his most intimate moments. The room had been one of the few places in which he was able to be himself, his mask set aside for a few seconds. The thought of stealing that for herself seemed too painful for her to face. Not until the passage of time had been given the chance to dull her pain at least a little bit. Dinner had been a welcome change from the sorrowful affairs of the day. The meal might have been a disaster had it not been for Drenata. Ashiel had dismissed almost all of the household servants until they could be thoroughly vetted by Zalukan. Zalukan's people were working as swiftly as they were able and had managed to clear several of the essential staff. Ashiel had made sure to move a few names up his list, including her personal carriage driver Chester and Renata. Ashiel had no clue how long Renata had served the family. She remembered the old woman occupying a position of authority in the kitchens as far back as she could recall, and strongly suspected that her father had quietly footed the bill for at least one juvenile treatment for Renata rather than lose such a skilled artisan. There were other chefs available who could produce larger and more sumptuous foodstuffs with greater presentation, but there was no one in the entire segmentum more capable when it came to making comfort food. Renata's skill at the hearth was surpassed only by her uncanny ability to properly remember people's culinary tastes years or even decades after having met them, sometimes only a single time. Ashiel had been delighted to find jugged gren, a menu choice so stigmatised as peasant food that she could never allow it onto a menu for a formal function, as well as a curious fish stew she couldn't ever recall having. To her surprise, Henrik had told her it had always been his favourite as a child. Henrik had insisted on asking Renata to dine with them, in defiance of tradition. But if it made her brother more comfortable, Ashiel approved. The Commodore was wise enough not to bring up any suspicions regarding the governor's death, so there were no major conflicts. But Henrik had precious little to add to the conversation, save for expressing concern that dismissing so much of her staff might be dangerous for Ashiel. Zaloukin assisted Ashiel in alleviating his concerns, laying out their plan for a swift and thorough vetting process. Hitting on an area of shared interest, Commodore Zaloukin was finally able to engage him by discussing the investigations of the various staff members. By feigning interest in Henrik's expertise, Zaloukin was able to draw the arbitrator out, and they managed to pass an hour or so in pleasantly diverting conversation. Still, as warm as the meal had been, and as welcome as Renata had managed to make them all, especially Henrik, Ashiel had reached the end of her reserves. This was the truly insidious part of death, she mused. For whom it affected most, an event which should have been a time of deep introspection and emotional self-indulgence was reduced to a litany of tedium. As if the endless decisions to be made, the never-ending tirade of false niceties, and the actual minutiae of running an entire planet weren't enough, she found herself dealing with a Celia Venason on top of it all. Ashiel groaned as she remembered the conversation with Celia. As much as she wished she could just surrender to her bed and let the leaden sleep of total exhaustion claim her, she knew that she needed to appraise Zaloukin of the latest development. She lurched to her feet, found a pair of slippers and padded into the night. There was a profound emptiness to the palace. All her life, Darkadin had been a veritable hive of activity. The halls of the palace had swarmed with servants, cooks, gardeners, menials, scribes and enforcers there to protect the governor's life. It had been easy for her to adjust to her father's demand that she live as if she were always under observation, because for the most part, she was. When Zaloukin finished his investigations, the palace would once again be a stellar system of activity. But it would be that she would be the sun at the centre of everyone's world. Cooks, artists, and consorts to provide her comfort. Enforcers and the high service to protect her person. Scribes, priests, and guildmasters to serve her. They would all rise and fall at her whim, their very lives dependent on her moods and favours. It was a sobering thought, and against the frightening immensity of that impending reality, she found the emptiness of the palace to be soothing in its way. The rooms seemed larger, devoid of people. Even the halls seemed like vast vaulted tombs, silent save for her echoing footsteps. She thought of meandering her path to the outer courses of the palace, cutting through the servants' quarters to greet them as she passed, but she discarded the notion. For one, the servants' halls were a place of refuge for them. She'd learned during her adolescence that no matter how much she cared for them, the labourers and maids didn't appreciate her presence. The social divide between them always made them uncomfortable. Secondly, she found the idea of being alone in the palace to be delightfully exhilarating.
She had rarely, if ever, been completely alone in her life, and the concept of total isolation filled her with a sense of thrilling dread. The kitchens were dark, the last of the menials having gone to their rest some time ago. Ashiel had offered to move Zaluk into the formal quarters for the officer of reconnaissance, but he'd politely asked to remain in his old office, connected by a short servant's corridor to the kitchens. Donata had long suspected the Commodore of sneaking into her domain for surreptitious snacking during late working sessions, often muttering threats of graphic violence should she ever catch him. The kitchens, like everything under Donata's purview, were spotlessly organised, with not a thing lying out of place. The servant's door, standing ajar, was out of place. It was a little thing, but neither Donata nor Commodore Zaluken were the type to leave a door hanging open. In the darkness, Ashiel fumbled along the sink for the first tool she could find with any real heft and tucked it to her chest. Borrowing a knife or meat tenderizer might seem a little overly paranoid to anyone who saw her, but her father had always taught her not to ignore instincts, especially ones that warned her of danger. The servant's corridor was better lit, and Ashiel paused to see what improvised weapon she selected for her defence. Her blinded hands had picked up one of Dranata's kitchen knives, decades old and wickedly sharp. Even in her panic, she had the absurd thought that if she didn't return it before the morning, the old woman would have words for her that would be equally sharp. She was surprised to see a servant coming from Zalukan's quarters. He had his back to her, a small serving cart taking up much of the hall. Embarrassed, Ashiel tucked the purloined knife to her side before the late-night snack-bearer saw it. She cleared her throat softly to draw his attention. The servant half-turned, then jerked his head back to his task.
"Sorry, Mum. I mean sorry, Excellency."
He hastily shuffled his cart a little further down the hall to allow her access to the Commodore's office. She realised as soon as she stepped into the office that Zaluken was dead. There was no blood and no signs of struggle, but still she knew. Commodore Zaluken lay with his head on his desk, one arm folded beneath his face as though he were merely resting. There was a subtle wrongness, however, a stillness to the scene that raised all immediate senses of alarm. She threw herself backwards, lest she be caught by the same assassin. Ashiel slammed into the servant in the hall behind her. She heard his surprised grunt, even as the las pistol in his hand went off, missing the intended target of her head and going wide into the room. The heat was positively blistering. No wonder there was no pooled blood. There was no time to waste being surprised. The servant was the assassin. She smashed backwards with one elbow and was rewarded with a grunt of pain and the sound of a pistol clattering to the stones. He shoved her into the doorframe, and it was her turn to grunt in surprise.
"Good reflexes,"
the killer said. As his voice whispered in her ear, Ashiel realised she'd heard it before. She smelled that same clean, soapy scent before as well, a distinct lack of scent that finally clicked with the soft, effeminate voice.
"But you should have just held still. It would have been over quick that way."
She heard the sliding metallic sound of a weapon being drawn behind her.
"Lestrovsky," she snapped.
In the split second, the assassin paused at hearing himself identified. She struck. She spun, lashing out with the knife in her hand, slicing a deep line across the assassin's face. He yelped in pain and surprise, clearly not expecting her to be armed. She pushed past him and tore down the hall. The Venaissance hitman had pushed his cart back down the corridor, blocking off the way to the kitchens. She spun on her heel and raced down the other hall, not caring what direction she fled in, so long as she fled away from the armed killer behind her.
"There's nowhere to go, Excellency,"
Lestrovsky said from behind her. Ashiel ignored the voice and kept running. She could hear him continue, no longer yelling, but instead speaking too softly for her to hear. If he was having a conversation, it was over a Voxbead or other hand-portable comm system, despite such systems being illegal for the ordinary citizens on Shokan. That meant additional assassins. At least one more. The hallway opened into a small common area where the cooks and menials could gather together.
There were several such rooms throughout the servants' run of the palace, nearly all adjacent to main rooms, so that they could be used as staging areas for banquets and ceremonies. The hall continued away from the gathering place, but Asiel ignored that in favour of the stone staircase leading up to the main floors. It had been years since she had run through these hallways as a child, but if she remembered correctly, she was in the Mansiple's den, which abutted the game hall. Not the best refuge. The game hall had several antique fowling pieces on display between the mounted beasts, but hadn't held any functional weapons since the solstice banquet 2.5 centuries prior, when her great-uncle Clidian had shot and killed Delenlo Oldermeyer in a duel over a game of cards. Still, there was a private study off the game hall, which would have a vox unit she could use to call for help. No sooner had she started up the stairs, however, she heard the sound of another voice behind the door at the top. The door rattled. Asiel let out an involuntary gasp, and the rattling stopped.
Nostrovsky?
The voice on the other side of the door was muffled, but the speaker had clearly heard her. She fled back down the stairs, leaping from the edge to the ground. She could hear footsteps coming down the hall. The fireplace was her only refuge now. Counting herself lucky that no one had used the fire for days, Asiel shoved herself into the chimney space. The passage was narrow, but there was just room enough for her between the hearth and the damper. Fortunately for her, the sweeps had been diligent in their duties before the death of her father, and the few remaining servants had apparently had little use for the Mansiple's den, and there was only the thinnest build-up of soot above the hearth. She wedged herself in high enough to be hidden from view, and then froze. She could hear Lestrovsky stalking through the common area. Her face, covered in ash, itched ferociously. Her arms were already throbbing from holding her own weight aloft in the chimney. The ridges where the brick passed into her sides were beginning to bite, but she didn't dare move. Even the slightest shift could betray her position, and the thought of being dragged from the wall by her ankles and shot dead, covered in filth, and crawling across the floor was intolerable. Asiel could hide, but she didn't know how long it would take for forces she could trust to get back inside the palace. The Venetians couldn't have turned everyone, or even most of her staff. If they had, they would simply have declared a coup and placed her under arrest. No. An assassination meant that they lacked widespread support. All she had to do was to escape the immediate attack and find help, and she could finally... Hands grabbed at her legs, and Asiel kicked out. The grip was like iron, though, and she found herself hauled bodily from the fireplace. She landed hard, stumbling into the side of the hearth, and her knife tumbled from her hand. Determined not to go down without every bit of fight she could muster, Asiel pushed off the wall and rushed her attacker. She brought herself up short as she realised it wasn't Lestrovsky. She recognised Renata's hunched shoulders and gnarled hands and froze, her fist raised high.
"It's not safe, lady."
Renata had always had a knack for understatement. If she was at all concerned that the governor had nearly punched her in the head after being found hiding in a chimney, it didn't show. The ancient servant turned and pulled her shawl about her.
"This way. Come quickly."
"Out the butcher's gate?" asked Asiel, recovering her kitchen knife. Renata shook her head. Her voice was like a whisper.
"They're out there, governor. Came in that way. Killed Lavini's little grandson on the way in."
Renata gestured towards a door with one angry hand. Asiel realised the old woman was holding a large carving knife, even bigger than her own.
"Stuffed him in a box hedge. Even took his pistol."
Asiel shook her head, realising that Renata was talking about one of the high service, not an actual child. The old woman produced her own key and unlocked the door. Behind them, Asiel could hear someone pounding on the door of the Mansiple's den. Faster footsteps sounded more distantly in the halls, and this time she was certain they belonged to her would-be assassin. The hall beyond was pitch black, but Renata drew a small luminator globe from her pocket. "Where are we going?" Asiel asked. She looked around for something she could improvise into a weapon, but as far as she could tell, they were in a side hall that led to servants' quarters.
As far as she knew, Donata's own room was this way.
To hide you, Governor, until I can fetch Lord Henrik, that is.
Donata held the Luminator out, the knife hidden beneath the folds of her shawl. The way she held it, down and ready, the old maid could deliver a vicious jab to anyone closing in on her. Ashel shuddered to think how close she had come to being gutted by her own servant without realising it.
There's a coup afoot, and I don't know yet who among the military still keeps your faith.
Ashel shook her head. It isn't a military coup. Trinata, ever obedient, stopped and turned to regard the governor. If it was, they would have tried to arrest us all, not have us murdered in our sleep. Trinata didn't ask who was behind the attack, just waited patiently for the governor to explain as much as she wished. Ashiel could have simply issued commands to the elderly maid, but speaking aloud helped her to work through her thoughts. Her servant's mention of Henrik had been a good thought, but her brother had chosen to stay at the guest house, unattached from the palace and at the edge of the property. By the time someone fetched him and returned, the assassins would likely be gone or else successful in their task. The little fiend who killed Commodore Seleucan is one of Acelia's creatures, she said. He was in disguise, but he's definitely working for the Venaissins. I'm sure they've got some clever story waiting to explain my gruesome death, of course. He's not alone, either. There's at least two of them, so there's no telling how many avenues of escape they've... She grimaced in the darkness, suddenly furious with herself. Escape. The escape tunnels. She knew why the thought hadn't occurred to her. She'd always been forbidden to go into them while her father was governor, and she had only had access to them for a short time. Still, it was something she should have thought of. I confess I don't remember the layout of these particular halls, Ashel said, peering around a door jamb into a small bedchamber. Can we get to the Draper's Hall from here? The corridor near there has a side room that Father always said led to an escape tunnel. She'd never been in the tunnel, but if it was to be of any use, an escape tunnel had to remain of the utmost secrecy. So she understood Ruprecht's insistence that no one but himself be allowed inside. Drunata, ever faithful to her liege, led the way through the darkness. She paused at each intersection, peering around corners with furtive glances, swift and subtle enough to avoid the notice of even the most keen-eyed observer, gesturing for her lady to follow when the route was clear, or to backtrack if the old woman saw or heard another figure moving. Ashiel suspected they would have made better time if she'd had her own key. Several times they were forced to divert around a quicker route because Drenata's own key wouldn't open a locked door. Nevertheless, the aged maid was true to her task, and Ashiel soon recognised the smell of sour hops from the Draper's Hall. Similar in size and purpose to the Manciple's Den, the Draper's Hall had seen more recent use. The coals in the fireplace were still glowing, and there was a small scattering of empty wine bottles and dirty plates on the stools around the room. Drenata tutted in horror at the mess, ignoring their peril for a moment to mumble something about lazy footmen, accompanied by a menacing waggle of her knife. Once in the side corridor, Ashiel found what she was looking for, easily. The door looked just like another servant's door. The door handle, of course, went nowhere. Instead, it pulled open like a hinged cabinet to reveal a small gene-code pad and screen. Ashiel silently hoped that the Biolock's machine spirit wasn't feeling obstinately loyal to her father and pressed her thumb to the pad. After a moment of spine-chilling suspense, the light flashed green. Ashiel breathed a sigh of relief. Then the magnetic lock surrounding the door disengaged with a deep, reverberating thump. She winced and listened to hear if one of the searchers had heard the door. After a moment, she picked up the sounds of footfalls approaching rapidly.
Time to run, lady.
Drenata squared her shoulders and stood between Ashiel and the direction of the approaching footsteps.
Come with me, Ashiel said.
No, lady. Her servant shook her head. My old knees shan't take any more running. So go now before they catch up.
She pointed emphatically with her knife, forcing Ashiel to step backwards. She realised her mistake, realised she'd stepped through the door, but too late to stop Dranata from slamming it closed. The magnetic lock slammed home with a resounding boom, even louder in the confines of the tunnel on the other side. Ashiel cursed in language that would have appalled her father, although Dranata would have approved. If the old lady was smart, she would follow her original plan and find somewhere to hide. She could feel a panel on her side of the door, but it didn't respond to her touch. The tunnel was short and opened not into an escape route, but a vault. The walls were lined with tables, each stacked with a profusion of junk in no particular order. Bits of art were scattered through the chamber along with stacked furniture, piled books, and folded uniforms. Luminators in the wall came on automatically, the machine spirits dutifully responding to her presence. She had no idea such a vault had even been here, and there was no time for satisfying curiosity. She immediately began searching for either a weapon or another way out. The room seemed to be stocked with items of no particular importance or even value. She recognised a portrait leaning against one wall as being of General Terrasant, executed for heresy a few centuries prior. She saw a few pieces of jewellery she remembered from her childhood as being gifts from a rogue trader, gifts that her father had confiscated after a number of the trader's other buyers had been sanctioned for possessing Xenos artefacts. A vault of heresy, then. Nothing too egregious, she'd wager, but the sort of things a planetary governor might need to hang on to in case the Inquisition ever came calling with probing questions about past events. At the same time, not the sort of thing one wanted to display openly. She found a lasgun with an Astra Militarum uniform from an unrecognised regiment, but the power pack was cold and dead.
Assassins! Invaders!
A piercing shriek cut through the gloom, audible even through the thick stone between her and the hall. Ashiel recognised Renata's voice, but she'd never in her life heard the woman so loud. She heard faint noises of a scuffle, followed by a loud bang against the door. She froze, wondering if they had already heard her, or if she had yet gone undetected. She could hear muffled voices in the hallway, but only make out part of their conversation.
We knew there was a possibility of tunnels.
I can get through this, my lord. If I may suggest a departure, the entire endeavour would be for nothing if the wardens or the High Service were to find you here when they arrive.
She recognised Lestrovsky's voice. His unseen companion said something she couldn't make out.
I can escape covertly, my lord, although not if I'm accompanied by another.
The other voice grumbled something and she could hear them depart. After a moment, she heard the faint sound of beeping beyond the door, and her blood ran cold. Lestrovsky was assaulting the gene code pad itself to circumvent the lock. His wickedness had already been evident, but that he was skilled not only as an assassin, but in the ways of perverting the works of the Adeptus Mechanicus, tantamount to sorcery. Ashiel turned back to ransacking the room. Oh, there had to be something. She knocked books and scrolls to the ground in her haste, certain there had to be some method of salvation hidden in the room. Finally, she knocked aside a stack of handbills, over a century old, advertising a play titled The Last Revel of Axmot by Rheimgold of Valgast, and saw her rescue. A small door set in the corner. The door was tiny and easily overlooked. It barely came up to her chest, and was no more than half a yard wide. In no place to be picky, Ashiel threw her weight into the table blocking the door. She shifted it just enough to access the portal. The tiny door had no lock, only a corroded metal knob that she feared would snap under the lightest pressure. To her great relief, the mechanism stood true and slid free easily. The door still refused to open. She checked the hinges, confirming it should swing inwards rather than out towards her, and began putting gentle pressure on the door. Behind her, the magnetic locks disengaged with a scream of protest. Desperate, Ashiel threw her shoulder into the door. It squealed and shifted just a little. The door from the hallway boomed open behind her and she threw herself onto the escape hatch again. This time, it fell open with a groan and a small shower of rust. She heard the sound of a las pistol firing behind her and slammed the door shut, trusting its heavy weight to protect her against gunfire. A bang and a bloom of heat on the metal proved her trust to be well-founded. She pressed her shoulders into the door, noticing as she did so a rusty bolt mechanism. She slid the bolt home just in time to see the door rattle in its frame.
"The longer you make me chase you, the more painful this is going to be," he said.
Here, finally, the facade dropped, and she could hear the real Ostrovsky. His voice rasped, the softness and sophistication gone. Here was a killer who had clawed his way from the gutter to the halls of power. His true voice revealed him for what he was, a predatory animal draped in the guise of a man. Ashel refused to engage. The hallway beyond the door was little more than a landing, with a narrow stone staircase beyond that curling down into darkness. The air was heavy with the smell of moisture and rotten stone. She held her illuminator out, but the light it cast was swallowed up by the immense darkness. The door behind her rattled again, and she took a first trepidatious step onto the staircase. The stone neither crumbled nor slipped, and she continued on. The staircase was narrow, the walls close enough to brush her shoulders, and barely taller than she was. This was not the sweeping, vaulted architecture of the Imperium with its soaring, complex construction that drew the eye upward to reflect on the divine. This was something far older. The dry-fitted stones and narrow spaces spoke to old Shoke construction, from the time when the Empire of Mankind had forgotten about their planet. There were alcoves cut into the walls at shoulder height, filled with moss and cobwebs. In times long past, they would have held flickering candles to illuminate the passage, and the skulls of trespassers, their brows engraved with scrimshawed warnings to anyone who would repeat their folly. The air turned cool quicker than she would have expected. The warmth of the palace soon left behind. Beads of moisture ran down the walls this far down. Beneath her feet, the path had become less sure than it had originally been. She could feel the damp squish of moss and the occasional shift where the surface of the stone had been eaten into sand. Her own footfalls were swallowed up by the darkness. Sights of the old Shoke civilization were rare. The Shoke culture that had existed before reunification had shunned the imperial creed and was considered heretical. Even possession of old Shoke artifacts was a crime. At irregular intervals, of a century or century and a half, some small ruin of Shoke culture would be found. Spiralling pre-Gothic carvings in a weathered sandstone cave, vine-shrouded foundations of a long-vanished stone building, or a piled stone cairn atop a remote seaside cliff. These had inevitably set off a flurry of activity, with the administratum removing the artifacts of the forgotten past and the governor relocating anyone whose property had contained the redacted history. She padded down the staircase, listening to the echoes of distant, squeaking rodents, and wondered how this sight had gone unnoticed for so long. She couldn't have been the first governor to open the little door. The mechanism might have stuck, but it had moved too smoothly to have gone unused since before the Matkison ascension. If her father hadn't used the door, her grandfather certainly had. What was the original purpose of this hidden place? And why had Ruprecht felt the need to lie to her about it? The staircase ended, and Ashel groaned. The hallway in front of her branched, and holding her illuminator aloft, she could see the passage in either direction curving away. Further branches barely visible in the gloom, moisture beading along their mossy walls. A damned maze. Of course. The old Shokes had loved their mazes. They'd built their cities and their dwellings like labyrinths and constructed elaborate puzzle paths outside the largest homes. The capital run much more sensibly, in a defined, grid-like pattern based around large avenues running east to west. The tradition had survived in part, however, and most of the nobles kept at least a small maze on their property to show, or to pretend to show, a connection to the planet's past.
Many of the oldest cities on the planet were still laid out in the branching, spiralling patterns her forebears had preferred before the Imperium came. Far away, Ashiel heard a metallic shriek. Her heart leapt. Nostrovsky had figured out a way to force the little door. Or soon would. Swallowing her fear and forcing herself to maintain a calm footing rather than race into the darkness, she turned to her right. Fortunately for her, after a harrowing reunification day ball that had left her crying in the grounds maze as a child, Jordan had showed her the trick of defeating virtually any maze with an external entry and exit. She put her hand on the right wall and began walking. She passed the first branch, keeping her unbroken contact with the wall. The stone was damp, rough. She trailed her fingers along the wall as lightly as possible, knowing that Lestrovsky would be able to track her if she left trails in the moss and mould that grew there. The path was slick now, the stone uneven and worn by the ministrations of the centuries. She was too far to turn back now, and she kept her course, heading long into the darkness. The wall curved inward and she followed it. Ashiel imagined she could hear Lestrovsky in the maze with her, and realizing how it might give her away, she stashed her luminator in her pocket. She took each step carefully, reaching out with a tentative toe-tap before committing her weight to the irregular floor. The wall shifted and turned, but she kept to her course. Jordan's trick might take some time, depending on the layout of the maze, but it was infallible, and she had to trust it. That assumed, of course, the maze was wholly natural. Like the population at large, the Imperium intended her to be entirely ignorant of the practices of heretics. Like most with her wealth and station, of course, she knew more than she was supposed to. Whispered legends among the wealthy and the learned hinted that the ancient Shok peoples might have dabbled with warp sorcery before the coming of the Aquila. Could her father, her entire family, have conspired to keep a haven of such sorcery secret from the world they governed? Just as she was beginning to despair, convinced she had found a dark and twisted labyrinth, the solution of which would open a portal to some nether hellscape, she came out of the maze tunnel and into an open room. The ground beneath her feet looked uneven, like natural stone. Ashiel paused, scanning the floor, and realized she couldn't see any seams in the masonry. For all she knew, at some point the ground had transitioned to smooth stone. Of far more interest were the trophy racks. She had seen illustrations of old Shok trophy displays, had even seen a recreation in the museum at Penenvost, but she'd never thought that she would see an authentic one, much less several. Standing waist high, the wooden rails served as a set of primitive shelves, which could be used to display bones or weapons from fallen enemies. They were believed to have been placed on borders to warn away attackers. She'd never heard of them being buried like this, as though they were some form of grave goods. The ones in front of her had a few scraps of what might have once been banners or pennants, or could just as easily have been enemy scalps. The degradation was too great to tell. Several weapons that looked like they were fashioned from bones also decorated the trophy racks. Her circumstances precluded any kind of detailed examination of the artifacts. The bone weapons looked worn and dulled by the centuries, and she doubted any of them would have survived even a cursory swing. She tapped an experimental finger to a curving sickle. She shuddered to think what sort of beast was large enough to produce a bone so big it could be carved into such a weapon, and was unsurprised to find it brittle to her fingertip. The trophy racks were arranged in the room to impede progress through it, but she threaded her way through easily enough. Stacked against one wall was a rotting skeleton. Although the flesh and whatever clothing it had been wearing were so far gone, there was no way to tell if it had been laid to rest here or entombed by some past governor. She hoped the former. The tunnel opened into another worked room. The room may very well have been a natural formation when the ancient architects had begun their work on it, but it had clearly been modified by the touch of human hands. Limestone stalagmites dotted the room irregularly, each carved by master artisans into whirling columns of fire.
The columns were hollow, the bases blackened. The stone flames wrapped over and under one another, turning each stalagmite into a massive lantern that could be lit from within. Bas-reliefs climbed the walls, framing a huge stone archway. To her surprise, the large arch led nowhere. It was merely a ring of stone set into the wall, with the floor sloping up to the bottom portion of its curve, as though a pedestrian could walk right through it. In the centre, however, was a recess of perhaps 3 feet, then nothing but solid stone. She tapped her fingers along it, trying to see if there was a catch or seam. The interior seemed to be nothing but natural stone, pitted by water damage. The outer ring was a different story. There was trailing moss which had grown into the cracks, but the structure of it appeared completely undamaged. It was made of some material altogether different to the limestone around it. The ring looked pale beneath her luminator, and when she touched her fingers to it, it was painfully cold. She snatched her hand back and swore that the spots of the stone where she had touched were brighter, as if they had retained some of the warmth they had stolen from her. All along the length of the stone ring were strange carvings she couldn't quite place. They were a strange combination of simple geometric shapes and jagged lines, and put her in mind of primitive pictograms, although they conformed to no human alphabet she knew of. The phrase, "no human alphabet," leapt out, highlighting itself in her mind, and she turned away from the wall carving. She felt an itch between her shoulder blades as if some unseen eyes were following her. Far away in the darkness, she heard the scream of the tormented latch finally giving way. The arch was no longer relevant. She needed to find a way out immediately. The large room was covered in stonework showing the primitive deities and myths of the old Shok, but there were no exits. There were no alcoves, no hiding places. After all her running, she was trapped. She tightened her grip on the kitchen blade and steeled herself against the rising despair. Maybe she could still conceal herself. Lie in wait. Ambush Lestrovsky. Ashiel lifted the luminator in front of the archway, checking to see if there was a place she could hide within the alcove. As she peered at the corners of the alcove, she spied something she hadn't seen the first time, wedged into a corner. She lifted her luminator and stifled a scream. Wedged in the edge of the space behind the stone ring was a corpse. The body in the arch was far better preserved than the bundle of rags and bones in the trophy room. The cadaver's sex was indeterminate, but it had evidently mustered the composure to die with dignity, for its emaciated form was hunched into a crouch, its back to the wall. Dried, blackened skin stretched taut over knobbly bone. She had never seen a creature so gaunt and withered. Then it opened its eyes. She would have screamed if her mouth had been capable of sound. The eyes glowed red, like dying embers in a neglected campfire. Their destructive power was long past, banked almost to the point of obscurity, but promised danger to the unwary. Impossibly, the thing stood. Its bones should have creaked with the weight of ages. Its skin should have cracked and flaked away. But somehow it moved as part of her knew it always had, all sinuous undulation and oily grace. "Abomination," she whispered. She stood frozen, unable to accept what she was seeing. She knew she should run, strike out, do something, but all her training and discipline failed in that moment. She was like a game animal, frozen in terror as the baying of hounds closed in around her. How had such a thing come to be beneath the palace? Surely her father couldn't have known about this horror. "No." The voice didn't seem to be speech, not quite. It echoed in her ears, seeming to come from everywhere at once, as though the creature was speaking through the darkness itself. It reached out for her, and she flinched, but its hand stopped short of the threshold of the alcove. The crystals set into the wall glowed dimly. What
What are you? She demanded. The question came as a matter of instinct, her mind compelling her to talk her way out of a situation she surely could not fight. Her hands were shaking with terror, and she could hear a quake in her voice that repulsed her.
Your kind has many names for mine, once.
The thing stood tall in front of her. She knew, in the animal part of her mind, that she should run. There was nowhere to go, though, and she knew that just as surely. With no other option, she met the creature's stare with one of her own. There was a tension to the monster, a primal tightness that reminded her of beasts she had seen caged. No, not caged, leashed. The thing appeared to be standing straight, but it was straining, leaning forward, unable to move past the edge of the stone ring. You're trapped, she said. The realization brought the tiniest bit of reassurance. The thing was dangerous, alien even, anathema to mankind, but the knowledge that it was restrained allowed her higher reason to come creeping back, abating the paralyzing fear enough for her to function.
Yes!
From the darkness, she could hear Lestrovsky's footfall splashing into the puddles at the base of the staircase, and a profane string of curses as he, too, saw the maze he must navigate.
Is there any other way out of here?
She whispered. She hardly expected a reasoned reply, but the situation was desperate.
Not anymore,
the creature said. The imprisoned thing did not mimic her hushed tone. She prayed that Lestrovsky couldn't hear the sibilant hissing of the shadows. It stared at the knife in her hand, then back through the darkness over her shoulder, as if it could see through the shadow and through the stone itself. It looked back at her.
The other comes.
There was no threat in its words, merely a statement of bare fact. Ashiel could hear Lestrovsky cursing and shuffling in the maze. As cunning a beast as he was, apparently the labyrinth was more of a challenge for him than it had been for her. She searched the room again, ignoring the creature behind her. There was no place to hide, no alcoves, no corners. She couldn't duck behind one of the stalagmites, even. They were too thin and carved through with so many openings that the assassin would see her in an instant.
Do you need me to stop him?
She turned back towards the imprisoned thing. It stood there, staring at her. Limp strands of white hair clung to it like trailing ferns.
What did you say?
She asked. She recoiled as the creature reached out a hand again, and this time she could see the runes on the pale stone ring throb with pale energy.
I still give honour to the ancient packs,
the creature said.
The ancient packs.
She looked at the room again, seeing it with fresh eyes. This was no shrine to the worship of foulness. It was a cage built by the old Shoke rulers, an oubliette.
What pact is that?
She asked.
What do you get for your service?
In business, politics, or foulest sorcery, nothing came for free.
Flesh and blood,
it said.
The key to all great endeavours.
It ran one hand along the wall of its prison, as close as it could get to the stone ring.
In times long past, each new ruler to inherit the mantle of the ancient pact would anoint their gate with a sacrifice.
Ashel scowled in contempt. The very notion was appalling. There could be no further discourse. Living sacrifice was the mark of the most blatant heresy. Only the master of mankind was revered enough to take the souls of humanity. I have no one to sacrifice to you, she said. Nor would I be inclined to do so, even if I had. In the darkness, its face split wide, revealing a grin of tiny, sharpened teeth that shone impossibly white.
You misunderstand, said the thing. The pact is sealed with a token offering of your own blood and flesh.
Through the darkness, she heard the electric flash of a laser gun firing and the clatter of falling bones. Bystrovsky had navigated the maze. She looked down at the knife in her hand. She was aghast. Was she really contemplating such a thing? To unleash a warp-tainted monster on her enemies in defiance of all that was holy. It was heresy to even think of such a thing, let alone to actually do it. To compound that, there was no surety the creature would be held to its word. She saw Lestrovsky's Luminator stabbing through the darkness, and she knew she had no choice. Trying to fight Lestrovsky would be suicide. Dying alone, forgotten in this oubliette, would accomplish nothing but the delivery of her own planet into the depraved hands of the Venaissans. She put one hand on the wall, her fingers splayed out, and steeled herself. She'd never suffered any truly grievous injury before, and her hand shook at the thought of mutilating herself. There could be no room for doubt, though. Her father, her grandfather, the line of governors stretching back millennia wouldn't have so carefully concealed and maintained a tool that didn't serve a purpose, that couldn't be controlled. Ashiel shut out the drawn, hissing sounds from within the ring, the wooden clattering as Lestrovsky picked his way through the trophy racks, and the hammering of her own terrified heartbeat. She placed the knife carefully at the lowest joint of her index finger, took a deep breath, and threw her weight onto it. The pain was unbelievable. Agony like nothing she'd ever encountered in her life lanced through her hand like a cold sheet. She reeled, feeling her vision fading, and forced herself not to succumb to shock. She looked down and nearly fainted when she saw her finger. Severed less than halfway through, blood was gushing down her hand. She could see little yellow fat deposits glistening in the wound. With a desperate surge of adrenaline, she slammed the butcher knife down and finished the job.
"The ring,"
the creature hissed. Its voice was thin and high. She slapped her hand onto the pale stone ring. The cold shock snapped her back, numbing her arm from her mutilated finger to the elbow. Ashel saw the blood soak into the ring. She heard the hiss as the runes around its length flared to life. She saw the circle of light cross over her and the stone ring as Lestrovsky came into the room. She heard his cry and tried to turn, waiting for the shot that never came. There was a sensation of motion, but no sound, no rushing of wind, just an icy chill that she could feel in her bones. And the feeling of the creature from the cell surging past her. Lestrovsky's pistol flashed, but hit nothing save shadows. The assassin lurched to the side as if struck, and his Luminator fell away, shattering on the stone floor. The only light was the muzzle flare of Lestrovsky's las pistol, as the assassin fought desperately for his life, capturing the scene in a series of snapshots. Flash. She saw Lestrovsky backed against an alcove wall, the creature stalking him, crouched and feral. Flash! The creature in mid-leap, Lestrovsky trying to retreat, his back already against the stone wall. Flash! The monster on top of Lestrovsky, holding the assassin's arm out by the wrist, preventing the pistol from being brought to bear, its mouth opened wide to reveal rows of identical, tiny, triangular teeth. Ashiel lowered her shoulder and rushed out of the dungeon. There was no way to see, no light at all. She could hear